Birkenhead was soon left behind, and at Holyhead the ship stopped and our pilot was put ashore. After we had left port, the first mate, Mr. Large, had called me and Frost and told us to clean up. The ship was filthy, with coal dust lying everywhere, bits of rope, timber, rags all over the place. Before lunch together we tidied up the bows. Lunch was at 12 o'clock, and afterwards swept it. It was a foul job, leaving us sweaty and covered with coal dust. Dinner was at 7 o'clock, and afterwards I went to my bunk in the forecastle in total silence. I felt the crew didn't appear to like my presence at all, at sea. Monday, 5th of June, 1939. My first real day at sea. At 5 o'clock promptly I was introduced to a cup of dark brown liquid called tea and a slice of bread and butter. I dressed hurriedly, hardly bothering to wash or clean my teeth. Going outside there was a lot of activity on the deck, for here the day begins early at 5:30. I spent the next 2 hours swabbing down the decks under the sharp eye of the boatswain. After breakfast Frost and I reported to the first mate. The first job this morning was to store boxes away in the bows, and the second to clean up again as we did yesterday. Frost is a very quiet but strong companion. The other two midshipmen are taking watches, so they will not be working with us until after port set. From 11 to 5:15 there is a break. In the Navy I gather this break is called a stand easy, but here it's simply known as a smoke. Everyone appears to be great smokers on board. I suppose it is because cigarettes are so cheap, a shilling for 50 woodbines and 1 shilling and 6 pence for 50 players. This afternoon I met one of the great characters of the ship. Everyone seemed to call him Bose, short for Bosun. I gather that, next to the captain, he is the most important man on the ship, a sort of sergeant major. I was walking under the bridge with my hands tucked in my pockets whistling when the boss came up to me and said, "Young fellow, there are two rules of sea never to forget. One, don't walk around with your hands in your pockets, and two, don't whistle, particularly when the captain is having his afternoon nap, and that is right now. If you wake him up there will be hell to pay for everyone and you will never hear the end of it." He had come upon me silently and walked away silently. Tuesday, 6th of June, 1939. Started off the day swabbing decks. After breakfast was given the job of washing down the captain's deck. I was sent to find a bucket and pinched the first one that came into sight. Together Frost and I toiled and struggled with scrubbing brushes and soap, our only reward being red knees from kneeling on the hard deck. At about 10:30 I was approached by a Chinaman who claimed that I had stolen his bucket. Naturally I hotly denied this accusation and a really grand quarrel developed. However, as usual I was in the wrong, and it turned out that the bucket I had pinched was his. At 11 o'clock smoke. At 11:30 the doctor vaccinated me against smallpox and tropical diseases. Then we stored pulleys from the derricks, and after that began to sand and canvas the bridge rails. This is a job which is very good exercise for the wrists. It is a matter of putting a bit of sand on a small bit of rolled up canvas and rubbing like hell. You then wash off the result with soap and water. 12:30 to 1:30, lunch of soup, hot pot, sausages, pudding, cheese and coffee. After lunch cleaned the brass in the wheelhouse, the compass, speaking tubes, wheel, etc. This is hard finger work and the brasso remains on my clothes and I hate the smell of it. My legs are very tired. Frost is still a silent companion. We break for tea at 3, which consists of one slice of bread, a small piece of cake and a cup of lukewarm tea, the color of mud. Today I have learnt one thing. Paint is called splash and you obtain it from a man called Lamps. After tea I went on cleaning up the brass on the bridge, and this time it was the portholes in the chart room. The morning was a cloudy one with a faint breeze blowing out from the land, but in the afternoon the clouds shifted and the sun eventually came out. We had not seen land, or ships either, but our position must be somewhere off the Spanish coast. Wednesday, 7th of June. 1939. This morning Frost and I cleaned out the bridgehead and swabbed the floor. After smoke we began washing the portholes and I learned that old newspapers are excellent for polishing brass. We both worked so hard that we were late for lunch and the captain showed strong disapproval, particularly as I think we interrupted one of his usual dirty jokes. In the afternoon we cleaned the captain's windows, very, very quietly. It must be lousy going on watch, Elliot, Roxby and Raymond always look half asleep whenever I see them. I found out one or two other things today, among them that the ship's carpenter is known as Chips and the wireless operator Sparks. Today we have passed or been passed by a good number of ships, for the most part cargo boats. Early in the morning we overtook a slow-moving Norwegian timber ship, lying low in the water and painted a dull grey colour. The troop ship Dorset passed by us on its journey back to England from Palestine. We could just hear singing in the distance. Today I began taking Morse code lessons from Sparks. The weather has been very kind. It was a lovely early morning with a cool, land breeze dying out as the day progressed and the sun became higher until the air was almost stifling. Our position is somewhere off the coast of Spain and after lunch we were able to distinguish the hard regular outline of Portugal with large, blue mountains in the background. The fight. After a few days I began to see how clever Mr. Holt had been to pay me a shilling a month. I was neither fish nor fowl, living with the crew and working with them half the time and the other half spent with the midshipmen and having my meals with the officers. I very quickly appreciated the enormous barrier between the officers and the crew, a barrier seldom breached and one on which I sat uncomfortably astride. The crew resented my close contact with the officers and the officers suspected they had a spy in their midst from the other side of the camp. It was at about this time that I began to realize that I had a flaw in my personality which had advantages and disadvantages. We had at home, for many years, a Staffordshire Bull Terrier. He was never aggressive himself or attacked other dogs, but perhaps there was an odor about him which attracted dogs of all shapes and sizes from miles around to come and have a go at him. He cheerfully bore the scars of these encounters. I seemed to have acquired the same odor which encouraged others to have a go at me. This manifested itself one evening in the forecastle. A very large seaman aptly called Tug suddenly exploded. "I dinna like your bleeding accent," he shouted at me across the floor. "Put your mitts up." He obviously had not been to a public school because before I had time to comply he hit me a heavy blow on the side of the head. I sprawled across the forecastle into the arms of a jeering semicircle of crewmen. They unceremoniously pushed me back towards Tug. He smelt an easy victory and charged towards me, but this time I was prepared and, sidestepping, hit him hard on his large purple-red bulbous nose which burst like a ripe strawberry. One all. I realized that I had to keep out of his huge arms which, once wrapped around my body, would squeeze the life out of me. I maneuvered around him for a while but once more he closed and with a grunt of rage caught me another stinging blow. Again I fell back into the arms of the now shouting and excited crewman. Once again I was pushed forward and hit Tug as hard as I could in his large pendulous belly. It was like hitting a sponge, my hand went in and came out again without even making him wince. I cruised around him, wounded but not yet mortally, the blood on his nose had stopped flowing and through the red screen I could see the mad gleam of murder in his eyes. He hit me again and this time I went down on the deck. I got up slowly and he hit me once more. This time I didn't get up quite so fast. I suppose I hit him twice to his half dozen blows, my own were getting weaker while his were just as powerful. After one huge blow I went down again and the deck and the ceiling of the forecastle appeared to be one. My eyes closed and I knew with certainty I could not get up. I vaguely remember hands lifting me up and placing me on my bunk. I woke the next morning feeling as though I had been run over by a bus. All the crew, including Tug, solemnly shook me by the hand. I was one of them. Thursday, 8th of June, 1939. We arrived at Gibraltar at midnight. Going out on deck, I could see the neutral ground between Spain and Gibraltar. During the Civil War, the Spaniards had dug up this ground until the British pointed their guns at Algeciras, a brown-colored town just across the bay, when they quickly stopped. Algeciras itself was bombarded several times during the war. I could see the gun emplacements on the rock, and several guns and blockhouses were outlined against the blue sky. At breakfast, the captain told me that this would be the last bit of green we would see for a long time, and certainly the last sight of hedges for 9 months. My work this morning was to continue cleaning the brasswork, but across the bay I could watch an English destroyer churning up the waters into a white foam. Soon we left Gibraltar, a lion of a rock set in the sea. I was given a lesson on the wheel by Janan, a seaman. Steering the ship was really quite easy, although as Janan says, you have to know your ship, and it is very easy to start swinging from side to side once you get the wheel on the move. After lunch, Frost and I made a canvas case for a ventilator on the officer's deck. All I did was to squat beside him and hand him the tools when required. We finished work at 4:30. A canvas swimming pool had been rigged on the wireless operator's deck, so we all went to try it out, and it was not too bad. In the early evening, I continued with my Morse code studies. Friday, 9th of June, 1939. I have today at last worked out the pecking order on the ship. There are three layers, each quite separate and with their own cultures, living quarters and messes. The captain is the chairman, so to speak, of the company, and the first mate is the managing director. The captain never gives an order, but the first mate transmits his wishes to the bosun. The officers are the captain's board of directors. The bosun is the direct conduit through which the first mate transmits his orders to the crew. The white crew look after the ship, painting, cleaning and scrubbing it. They do not mix with the officers. The final layer is the 40 or so Chinamen who stoke the boilers under the chief engineer. They have their own mess and stick strictly to themselves. I am sandwiched somewhere between the first and second layers. Saturday, 10th of June, 1939. Swabbed the decks at 5:30, which is one mad rush around the ship with brush and hose, knocked down, drenched but still struggling on. Swabbing is undoubtedly the hardest and most unpleasant work, particularly on an empty stomach. The boss follows cool and silent, maneuvering the long heavy hosepipe, and if you don't work hard enough, he turns it on you. After breakfast, back to the windows, both on the bridgehead and then on the captain's deck. During the morning, I committed two crimes. In the wheelhouse there is a piece of cord hanging from the roof which rings the ship's bell, and while cleaning the windows my arm caught this and rang the bell, which began to peel away. I wasn't very popular. Next, I had finished cleaning the bridge windows and walked into the chart room thinking Frost was there, and without bothering to look around I said, "I am just going to clean the old man's windows, blast him." I glanced up and there was the old man grinning evilly at me. I swam and sunbathed after work, and already my muscles are tightening up and my body is becoming tanned by the sun and sea. God, it is getting hot and there is not a cloud in the sky, and only a gentle breeze makes it bearable. The eternal noise of the engines and the swift motion of the sea is making me nervy. Oh, to be in England! After dinner, the ship's doctor asked me into his cabin, where he gave me a glass of sherry and I enjoyed his cigarettes. Dr. Hart is a very pleasant character. He is about 5 feet 10 inches tall, with a small moustache, covering a slight hair lip. He is getting a bit thin on top despite his 32 years. It seems his hobbies are hunting and yachting, and he told me many exciting stories of his experiences at both. He tells me he only drinks port and always smokes Rhodesian cigarettes, of which he has about 2,000 on board. He wants to be a country doctor and hunt 2 days a week, but is now looking around the world and intends to visit a bastard branch of his family in Australia. To bed after a pleasant evening. Sunday, 11th of June, 1939. Weary the cry of the wind is, weary the sea, weary the heart and the mind and the body of me. Would I were out of it, done with it, would I could be a white gull crying along the desolate sands. and first I'll hear the sea winds, the mewing of the gulls, the clucking, sucking of the sea about the rusty hulls, the songs at the capstan in the hooker warping out, and then the heart of me'll know I'm there or thereabout. John Masefield, it is a glorious day. The sun is dazzling and the sea is a perfect picture blue. The Mediterranean is a wonderfully peaceful sea, calm and unruffled. It is difficult to believe that it ever could be rough, although I believe it is at times. In the morning we passed the island of Pantelleria. It is a rocky peninsula rising steeply out of the sea, and it has been fortified by Italy, hoping in the event of a struggle between our two countries to cut off the West Mediterranean from the eastern portion, thus making the Suez Canal unusable. At lunch I asked if they ever had church services on board ship. Not on these types of cargo ships, I was told. The second mate told us of a few of the experiences he had had on the passenger ships. He said he used to play the piano, and one fine day after a service he played God Save the King, and the captain had turned on him and in front of a very respectable lot of passengers had shouted, "What the hell do you think you are doing? This is a church service, not a bloody cinema." Tuesday, 13th of June, 1939. I was given one of the most unpleasant jobs that I have ever done, but it was my own fault. After breakfast, in conversation with the chief engineer, he happened to say, "What the devil do you want to come to sea for?" I replied that I was in search of experience. His eye took on a nasty glint, and in a smooth voice he said, "Experience you want? Well, I can give you an experience, lad. You report to me at 12 o'clock tonight in the engine room. I am one stoker short at the moment." That evening I retired to bed directly after dinner. At 11:30 a gruff voice woke me out of a dream, and still half asleep he crawled out of my bunk and dressed in some old dungarees and a white boiler suit which one of the engineers had lent me. Attached to it was a hood which tied round the chin. At first I did not understand the reason for it, but afterwards I did. On the stroke of 12 I climbed down the perpendicular steel ladder which led into the bowels of the Cyclops. My first impression of the engine room was machinery, one vast mass of revolving wheels and hissing steam, and the clicking of the dials on the instrument board. Dwarfing all else, the giant pistons stood out in all their power and eternal noise. This was a noise I heard all the time in the ship, a steady thump, 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 keeping to a beautiful rhythm, never altering its time, with annoying intensity. The noise in the engine room was tremendous, for besides the machinery there were the hurrying men bearing odd tools like grease pans and oilers. For a minute no one noticed me, but then a figure came up and shouted something in my ear which I did not hear, but, still dazed by the noise, I followed him down through a tunnel and finally out into comparative quiet. It was terrible here. I would have preferred the noise 10 times to the heat of that place. I was in the stokehold. 12 blazing hell holes gaping wide with the thermometers on the wall registering 120 degrees. Your first job will be trimming. You have to hack this coal into smaller pieces in here. And he led me through a door into a coal hole, and then you put the coal in this truck and pull it down to the fires, and then you do some stoking. And so he left me among the 25 Chinese stokers, the only white man in the hole. They all looked at me and I looked back at them. One of them spat at my feet, and that seemed to be the signal for them to start working again. So I heaved the hammer at the coal and broke it up, and then shoveled it into a truck and nearly broke my back shoving it and pushing it on the fires. The coal hole was quite cool after the awful heat of the fires. Once I slipped pushing the truck and fell into the coal, cutting my hands and legs. A Chinaman helped me to get to my feet again, and grinning excitedly went back to tell his fellows. My hands became blistered and my back began to ache. My legs to tire, and I began to curse. I think there were 3 things about the stokehole that will always remain with me: the high treble shouts, songs and laughter of the Chinese stokers. They were stripped to the waist and sweat poured down their bodies. Then there was the coal dust which choked and got inside my mouth, nose and eyes, and finally there was the heat, the blast as the doors of the fires were opened and we shoved the coal in with long shovels. At about 2 o'clock, the chief engineer appeared and said, "Okay, Horsley, you do look fine, and how's the experience going?" At this stage I couldn't care less and swore back at him. "Oh, don't get so rattled, young man, come and have a drop of tea." So back we went to the engine room, in the middle of which a table had been laid out with toast and cups of tea. All the other engineers were already eating hard, but I was introduced to them separately. The second engineer looked exactly like Mussolini and indeed was always called by that name, shortened to Musso. The youngest engineer was a Welshman called Hughes, and he told everyone that he loathed the sea. This was his first voyage, and he said he wished he was working back in the garage at £3 a week with none of the terrible noise and heat of the engine room. We finished tea and one of the engineers volunteered to show me round. First he led me through some long narrow passages and up some more iron stairs to a place he called the Turkish bath. This was a small room absolutely covered with pipes, so full of steam you could hardly breathe without choking. After a few minutes in here my chest was about ready to burst and sweat poured out of every pore. Then back to the engine room and I was shown how the engine worked. The system seems to be exactly the same as that for an aeroplane or car, except that coal is used to generate steam instead of petrol. The engineer then took me down a long tunnel which was where the main shaft was located. The shaft is slung on a long straight slide coated with lubricants and is round as a large tree, and two shafts turn the two gigantic screws. So at 4 in the morning I climbed back up the iron ladder and 10 minutes later flung myself fully clothed and exhausted onto my bunk. Wednesday, 14th of June, 1939, Portset. There is iniquity in many parts of the world, and vice in all, but the concentrated essence of all iniquities and all the vices in all the continents finds itself at Portset. And through the heart of that sand-bordered hell, where the mirage flickers day-long above the bitter lakes, move, if you wait, most of the men and women you have known in this life. The excitement, the gaming tables, the saloons, the dancing hells, the straight vista of the canal, the blazing sands, the procession of ships and the white buildings, all are Portset. Rudyard Kipling. God, I am tired this morning. I have just managed to struggle into breakfast feeling a complete wreck. After breakfast I was put to work again cleaning windows with the usual newspapers. After lunch I took out the pilot's ladder to the forward hatch and scrubbed it clean, and at about 3:30 we began to see what looked like posts and iron girders sticking here and there out of the sea. There was not a cloud in the sky and the sun was blazing down on our bare heads. We passed one or two native fishing boats, and suddenly the clang of the bridge bell and the cessation of the engines to a mere throb in the distance heralded the approach of a port. We rounded the buoys and slowly steamed up the narrow entrance to Portset and the Suez Canal. Winches were being tested and the air was full of escaping steam and shouts of the crew. The ship is surrounded by small boats called bum boats, piled high with brilliantly colored wares. Money and goods are exchanged in baskets pulled and lowered over the ship's rails. All things are for sale in Portset. I have never seen such a crowd in all my life. About 200 all told on the deck, some big, some medium, some small, all dirty and all crooks. Roxby bought a camera and I bought a tube of toothpaste which, when turned out of its wrapping, proved to be only half full. When the ship had finally been stripped of anything valuable and there was nobody left to swindle, the mob gradually disappeared. A few, like the Gully Gully men, stayed on. They played a betting game with 3 dice cups and a baby chicken. "Gully, gully, gully," they cried, "which cup hides the chicken?" Of course, you never could guess right against such nimble-fingered rogues and lost your bet. I went up to the first mate and asked him if I might go ashore, and he said I could. It was easy enough to obtain a boat as competition is keen, and the Arab who rowed me across was a cheery fellow dressed in a highly colored vest and earrings and with a prodigiously large nose. Portset is a large town with a big business community. It is built on a site which not long ago was a marshy salt lake. All nations walk in its streets and ships from every country pass through the port. East mingles with the West in this strange town. It really is a fascinating place and I had a wonderful time idling through the streets and looking at the crowds and shops. I had been told about the most famous shop of all, Simon Arts, and I purchased there what every Englishman is supposed to, a torpie, the cheapest in the shop. After a while wandering about I was rowed back to the ship and went back on board again. There is now a gap in my diary until we reach Penang, probably because a monsoon struck us shortly after leaving the Suez Canal. The captain said it was the worst weather he had encountered and all I remember is battling against huge seas while we lashed down the deck cargo and returned half drowned to the forecastle. We eventually docked in Penang and I decided to leave the ship and visit one of my sisters, who lived there with her husband, a government engineer. I was collared by them as soon as I went ashore, taken to their home, put in a shower and given some decent clothes. I eventually emerged looking more or less civilized. Penang, Wednesday 23rd of August, 1939. The latest, and what I imagine will in the future be known as the August Crisis, is getting well underway and gathers speed daily. It gives the impression of being even graver than the crisis of September last year. Germany wants to take over Poland and Danzig and include them in the Reich, naturally Poland objects. England is bound to Poland by treaty, so either Germany or ourselves have to give way and it must not be us. Therefore either Germany backs down or it will be war. Germany now holds the stage and the choice of the play, more correctly, perhaps, this is in the hands of her leader, Adolf Hitler. Friday 1st of September, 1939. At 4 o'clock this afternoon, for lack of anything better to do, I played with the dials on the wireless, idly tuning in first to Paris and then to dance music from London, and suddenly as I was tuning in to another station, an excited American voice, almost shouting, said, "Radio City has made an important announcement tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and for the last 2 hours terrible events have been happening in Europe." Following a broadcast by Hitler, it is reported that German troops have crossed the Polish border and have invaded Poland. Tune in to Radio City, New York, for all the latest developments. For a few minutes I sat dazed and silent. Had I merely dreamt the announcement or had the dreadful moment on which the fate of millions of people depended arrived? Had the guns begun to bark and the lights go out all over Europe? I could almost hear the battle raging and the drone of bombers, on their way to destroy Warsaw, triumphant and gloating. I could imagine the mutilated bodies of men and women and the still poor forms of little children. Oh God, what is happening to this world? Thousands of innocent people are going to be thrown into endless strife and misery, damn Hitler and may his heart rot in hell. Why has one mad human being the power to murder not only his own people but the people of other harmless nations? Surely this is not only God's power, but perhaps it is Satan's too, and is Hitler the Antichrist who finally conquers the world? Perhaps we are to see wondrous things in our time, but the coming war is going to be terrible. Saturday 2nd of September, 1939. I spent a restless day alternately listening to rather vague news bulletins and cursing the wireless. Eventually I tuned into a German station broadcasting in English. The announcer accused the British of creating the present situation and went on to say that Chamberlain entirely dominated the British press, further, that England did not appear to realize the damage they had done. When I tuned into a British wireless station they were still taken up with dance music. Sunday 3rd of September, 1939. This afternoon we all went out to the Penang Flying Club where one of the instructors took me up for a flight. It was a very lovely evening with the sun setting over the hills and the lights of Penang beginning to twinkle. After landing we walked to the clubhouse and found everyone listening to the wireless. Suddenly the announcer said, "We are taking you over to Downing Street where the Prime Minister will make a statement. I am speaking to you from the cabinet room of number 10 Downing Street.